Chapter 25. The mystery as to why, how, and by whom Dorothy Kilgallen was murdered will always be intertwined with the greatest murder mystery in history, the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. If JFK had not been slain on that tragic November day in 1963, there is little doubt Kilgallen would not have been killed 2 years later while investigating his death. Why has the president's assassination remained such a mystery for 55 years and counting? And how does it directly relate to Kilgallen's demise? Multiple suspects, with strong motive to have silenced JFK, as Kilgallen was silenced, abound. These include the CIA, speculation JFK was going to dissolve the agency, the Russians, hated JFK as a result of the Cuban Missile Crisis, Cuban dissidents, hated JFK because of the Bay of Pigs fiasco, the military establishment, hated JFK since he could end the Vietnam War by reducing military spending. President Lyndon Baines Johnson feared JFK would remove him from the 1964 Democratic presidential ticket. Regarding LBJ, recall that Kilgallen, in her column, "The Oswald File Must Not Close," demanded that the new president satisfy the public's uneasy mind about this peculiar assassination of the assassin, referring to Jack Ruby's killing of Lee Harvey Oswald. Her doing so must have troubled Johnson, causing he and his colleagues to keep a close eye on Kilgallen's future columns and articles. Apparently, Jackie Kennedy, denied justice since the truth about who killed her husband was covered up, believed LBJ was responsible for JFK's demise. According to tape recordings obtained by ABC News, the former First Lady blamed her husband's death on Johnson and a cabal of Texas tycoons who orchestrated the murder of JFK by gunman Lee Harvey Oswald. She added, "The Dallas murder was part of a larger conspiracy to allow Johnson to become American president in his own right." In October 2017, as part of the 2,981 previously secret JFK assassination documents released by the U.S. government, a 1966 memo forwarded to the White House by FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover alleged the KGB had data indicating Vice President Lyndon B. Johnson was behind the assassination, JFK's murder, and that it was a well-organized conspiracy on the part of the ultra-right in the United States to effect a coup. These theories, like others linking LBJ to JFK's death, and those involving the other agencies or groups mentioned, have proven through the decades difficult to sustain, since so many layers exist between those who had to act to eliminate JFK and those who had a legitimate reason for eliminating the president. When it comes to benefit from the crime, LBJ is at the top of the list, since he became the most powerful man in the world. However, to date, the evidence still runs short as to pinning JFK's death on LBJ or his minions. While speculation has run rampant since 1963 regarding many theories as to who assassinated JFK, most simply have no basis, especially those that follow the ludicrous Oswald Alone thread. One only has to read the Jack Ruby trial transcript excerpts presented here to realize the fallacy of any arguments pointing to the validity of J. Edgar Hoover's proclamation, one of the biggest lies in American history. Unfortunately, there are those who have no desire to speak up and break the mold, those who still, despite knowledge of Kilgallen's compelling investigation, fear her in death as much as they did when she was alive. Why? Because what she discovered does not fit with the conclusion they want to reach. Therefore, she must be ignored. This true distortion of history must be rectified, and one way to achieve this goal is to pinpoint who had the most to fear when Kilgallen was alive. The starting point is to understand Kilgallen's dedication to discovering the truth regarding who killed the president. It was a personal matter for her, due to the never-to-be-forgotten experience with the president touching Kilgallen's heart and soul when he treated her son Kerry so well during their White House visit. Recall that Kilgallen then wrote in her Journal American column, "The picture that stays in my mind is the one of this tall, young man bending over a small boy, carefully scrutinizing envelopes until he came to the name Kerry Arden Colmar, grade 3B. This is the man who was assassinated in Dallas." In addition, CBS producer Marlon Swing knew firsthand of Kilgallen's friendship with JFK. Swing was present in her townhouse the night Kilgallen returned from a Broadway opening. "The phone rang," Swing said, "and it was very late, 1:30 almost in the morning. It was Ted Sorensen, special counsel to the president. No small potatoes. They were talking, and I heard Dorothy say, 'Oh, really? Say hello to him, too.' Jack Kennedy had walked into the room, asked who Sorensen was talking to, and when he learned it was Dorothy, said, 'Say hi for me.'" Another eyewitness to the Kilgallen-JFK friendship was Bob Bach, Kilgallen's friend and What's My Line producer. He recalled, "At the Stork Club, I watched with a mischievous thrill as Jack Kennedy, a young senator out late with someone other than his wife, touched base with Dorothy. 'Hello, Dorothy,' he said. 'Do you remember the night we played charades at your house? What fun it was.'" Like everyone else, Kilgallen was expected to believe J. Edgar Hoover's Oswald alone theory. But when Jack Ruby shot Oswald, years of experience as an investigative reporter proved valuable, and Kilgallen knew something was wrong. That Ruby's actions had to be part of some preconceived plan. To figure out what that something was, Kilgallen decided action on her part was necessary. Of note is that during the time before she arrived in Dallas, Kilgallen's mindset had landed on evidence causing deeper concerns for the official government explanation of JFK's death. This must be true, since during jury selection, before she heard any of the trial testimony, recall Kilgallen said to reporter Jim Lehrer, "I don't see why Dallas should feel guilty for what one man, or even three or five in a conspiracy to kill the president, have done." To gain the best access to new information about the twin assassinations, Kilgallen, as she had done at the Shepard and Finch trials, needed to ally herself with either the defense or prosecution teams. She chose the former, deciding to focus on the one main aspect of the killings that she found hardest to believe: Ruby shooting Oswald. This deliberate strategy, one straying away from Oswald instead of focusing on him, as 99% of the journalists were doing, would prove fruitful beyond any of her expectations. Melvin Belli became the target, based on Kilgallen's research. Since Kilgallen always did her homework, she must have known he not only represented mobster Mickey Cohen, but was a close friend of his, a true mafia wannabe. Kilgallen had included Cohen in a September 26, 1958 Voice of Broadway column, writing, "Mickey Cohen, the California gangster, is about to tour the nation, lecturing on one of his favorite topics, corruption in politics." She was also well aware, as noted, that the mobster was at the forefront of organized crime a year earlier, when What's My Line moderator John Daly barred CBS's Mike Wallace from appearing on the show because he had interviewed Cohen. When Kilgallen arrived at the Ruby trial, there was no problem getting Belli to become interested in her. His longtime secretary, Joyce Revilla, told this author, "Belli chased everything with a skirt on." Both Belli and Kilgallen enjoyed the bright lights. If a day went by when Belli wasn't mentioned in the column written by San Francisco Chronicle legend Herb Cain, he complained. When he was photographed, Belli did so with his arm extended forward as if to warn, "You better pay attention or you'll miss something important I have to say." Belli loved the courtroom action, but had aspirations of an acting career. At one point, he was a guest star in a Star Trek television episode, and the children shall lead, as Gorgon, an avenging angel.
When Herb Kane told Belli that director Francis Ford Coppola was auditioning actors to play Don Corleone in the Godfather film, Belli read for the part. After Marlon Brando was chosen, Belli blasted Coppola in Kane's column. Was it possible that Belli, described as candid, controversial, and clever, lawyer Melvin Belli is a Perry Mason with showmanship, by Life magazine, could have bargained with Kilgallen? If she promised to introduce him to her Hollywood friends, he could give her good access to the defense team. Revilla believed this happened, the two trading favors, each benefiting. During later years, Belli never spoke about Kilgallen to the media. In his 1964 book, Dallas Justice, only one page acknowledges the famous reporter, with him writing, "Ruby did say he got angry at his favorite columnist, Dorothy Kilgallen, when she wrote that he was a gangster." In his autobiography, My Life on Trial, which numbered 351 pages, Belli mentioned Kilgallen briefly on one page. He wrote, "Dorothy Kilgallen was in Dallas for most of the Ruby trial and a frequent lunch companion of mine." Evidence of the prominent position Kilgallen enjoyed with the defense team is confirmed by viewing a videotaped press conference during the Ruby trial. Decked out in a spotted leopard top and holding an audio tape recorder in front of Belli, Kilgallen asked, "How long does a person have to live in Dallas to be a prospective juror?" Belli and Tannehill both answered. Later footage showed Kilgallen whispering in Tannehill's ear. This footage is available at www.thedorothykilgallenstory.org. That the narcissistic Belli never disclosed much about Kilgallen to his legal colleagues or friends, or in his books, was consistent with his behavior through the years regarding the Ruby trial. From the 1960s to 1995, when he died, he very much respected the mob's allegiance to the loyalty oath of Omerta, a code of silence. Belli's associate Kent Russell told this author, "I pumped him about it because I sensed something was wrong with his representation. But he wouldn't give any thought or consideration to a conspiracy. He just kept saying how bad Dallas was. He just totally shut the door about Ruby. He didn't want to go there. I never quite understood that." While Kilgallen's columns reflected a growing suspicion about what really happened in Dealey Plaza and the Dallas Police Department basement garage, it was the early exposure by her of Jack Ruby's statements to the Warren Commission that shouted to the world her intention to keep digging, to keep searching for the truth. Government agents attempted to learn of her secret source, but Kilgallen was defiant. Recall one portion of the FBI file memo noted before that read, "She stated that she was the only person who knew the identity of the source, and that she would die rather than reveal his identity." Ruby's testimony at the Warren Commission perpetuated Kilgallen's fervor to discover who killed JFK. The Journal American published the secret testimony on August 19, 1964, 5 months after the Ruby trial. When she learned he had told the media, "I have been used for a purpose, and I won't be around for you to come and question me again," Kilgallen added these statements to her thickening assassinations file. Later in his testimony, Kilgallen read where Ruby continued to request a lie detector test. She circled the words, "Gentlemen, my life was in danger here," and then, "I may not live tomorrow to give any further testimony." Realizing this connected with the column she had written where Ruby told her, "How scared I am." Into Kilgallen's file was added Ruby's never-to-be-forgotten statement while standing before what appeared to be a court railing, his arms gesturing as he spoke. Ruby said in an eerie tone, "The world will never know the true facts of what occurred, my motives. I am the only person in the background that knows the truth pertaining to everything relating to my circumstances. The people who have had so much to gain and have such an ulterior motive to put me in this position I'm in will never let the true facts come above board to the world." While much of the world, including her fellow reporters, scoffed at Ruby's revelations, since Belli had portrayed him as being insane. Kilgallen, based on what she had learned at the Ruby trial, as well as from credible sources, must have believed Ruby was actually telling the truth. This was the unvarnished Ruby, free of threats from those who had ordered him to kill Oswald and to keep his mouth shut about who had given the order. Of special interest to her was Ruby's use of the words, "the people who have so much to gain," a connection, it would seem, to those who benefited most from his having assassinated Oswald. Mention of ulterior motive could relate to Ruby's knowledge that JFK was killed for other than the obvious reasons bandied about at the time. Note, these chosen words could also relate to JFK being killed instead of the logical target, Bobby, as suggested by Ruby prosecutor Bill Alexander, since RFK had too many enemies, many more than his brother. Using every journalistic tool at her disposal, Kilgallen continued to attack the Warren Commission report. She apparently listed some 100 discrepancies to consider in a memo never published, and the overall investigations by the FBI and Justice Department. To Hoover, the FBI, and the Justice Department, each of whom wanted the Oswald alone theory to stick, Kilgallen was the proverbial thorn in the side, a topic of heated conversation at every staff meeting. Following her toxic assassinations columns, the Ruby trial coverage, the interviews with him, and her exposure of his testimony before the Warren Commission put her squarely in the direction of danger, one realized by Mark Sinclair, Charles Simpson, and James Clement as the months passed into late 1965. Kilgallen was not like other reporters. She had the power, the national forum, the proven credentials. Her Journal American column and investigative stories were taken seriously, and she had the influential Hearst Media Syndicate watching her back. Most importantly, Kilgallen had a solid reputation as a credible journalist. In the media world, Kilgallen was the main attraction. When she spoke or wrote, people listened and read with interest. True to her feisty nature, she not only refused to quit, she revved up the intensity of her investigation. Without question, Kilgallen was a marked woman, enemies circling, each with reason to silence the reporter who knew too much.